Where's my baby?
That's the lesson drawn out of two interesting stories over the last couple of days. First, the story yesterday that half of the kids in this country under 5 years old are minorities. By far, the greatest number are Hispanic. Know what that means? 25 years and the majority population is Hispanic. Why is that? Well, Hispanics are having more kids and others, notably the ones Hispanics called gabachos, white people, are having fewer. Now, in this country, European ancestry people, white people, are having kids at the rate that does sustain the population. It grows a bit. That compares to Europe, where the birth rate is in the negative zone. They're not having enough babies to sustain their population. Consequently, they're inviting in more and more immigrants every year to take care of things. And those immigrants are having way more babies than the native population, hence Eurabia. Why aren't they having babies? Because babies get in the way of a prosperous and comfortable modern life. Peanut butter fingerprints on the leather seats in the BMW. The Euros are in particular can't be bothered with kids. Underscore that second point. A second story today reports that Vladimir Putin is so concerned about the declining and imploding population of Russia, he is paying couples to have babies. Imagine, procreating for cash in Mother Russia. Putin is taking this step because it's the right thing to do.
You guys are supposed to be colorblind. What's all this talk about race concerning population when you're saying stuff like do your duty, make more babies, meaning white babies? What is this, a speech by David Duke or something? Or basically it is. It's out of Fox News. Then you say half the kids on Sam's plantation who are being born are minorities. Well, in reality, that's part of the reason why there's a prison industrial complex. Then you go on to say that in 25 years, the majority population, as things are headed, will be Hispanic. What happened to colorblindness? What's the difference? Right-wingers? So when you say we need more babies, we know what kind of babies you're talking about and what kind of model you're talking about. It's the same old thing, whether we're talking 1805 or 2005. It's still Sam's plantation. You know what time it is, slave time. Listening to 103.3, 101.1 freakradio.org for Skid in Santa Cruz, 104.1 Berkeley, 107.5 North Carolina, 96.3 Antelope Valley, Upstart Radio, LUVER.com, the world, radioforall.net, the universe. Click into the slave web, go slavevoteradio.blogspot.com, and check out two other comrade sites, propagandapress.org and SavageJustice.blogspot.com. Find out what time it really is. Tonight, we're going to deal with the blood money of the American Empire in its wars. We got all that and a hell of a lot more on 103.3. Slave Revolt.
Attention, seekers everywhere. I was right. Everything I knew was wrong.
You see, where they've gone, they're playing with the universe. They're playing with the solar system. But they have no perception and no way to measure what the amount of energy that's going to flow out from that light off
I spent 33 years in the Marines, most of my time being a high-class muscle man for big business, for Wall Street, and the bankers. In short, I was a racketeer for capitalism. War is a racket. It has always been. It is probably the oldest, easily the most profitable, surely the most vicious. It is the only one international in scope. It is the only one in which the profits are reckoned in dollars and the losses in lives. A racket is best described, I believe, as something that is not what it seems to the majority of people. Only a small inside, quote unquote, group knows what it's all about. It is conducted for the benefit of the very few at the expense of the very many. Out of war, a few people make huge fortunes. In the World War, a mere handful garnered the profits of the conflict. At least 21,000 new millionaires and billionaires were made in the United States during the World War. That many admitted there are huge blood gains in the income tax returns. How many other war millionaires falsified their income tax returns, no one knows. How many of these war millionaires shouldered a rifle? How many of them dug a trench? How many of them knew what it meant to go hungry in a rat-infested dugout? How many of them spent sleepless nights, frightened nights, ducking shells and shrapnel and machine gun bullets? How many of them parried the bayonet thrust of an enemy? How many of them were wounded or killed in battle? Out of war, nations acquire additional territory. If they are victorious, they take it. This newly acquired territory promptly is exploited by the few. The self-same few who wrung dollars out of blood in the war, the general public shoulders the bill. And what is this bill? The bill renders a horrible accounting. Newly placed gravestones, mangled bodies, shattered minds, broken hearts and homes, economic instability, depression, and all its intended miseries. Back-breaking taxation for generations and generations. For a great many years as a soldier, I had a suspicion that war was a racket. Not until I retired to civil life did I fully realize it. Now that I see the international war cloud again gathering, as they are today, I must face it and speak out. Again, they are choosing sides. France and Russia met and agreed to stand side by side. Italy and Austria hurried to make a similar agreement. Poland and Germany cast sheep's eyes at each other, forgetting for the nonce their dispute over the Polish corridor. The assassination of King Alexander of Yugoslavia complicated matters. Yugoslavia and Hungary, long bitter enemies, were almost at each other's throat. Italy was ready to jump in, but France was waiting. So was Czechoslovakia. All of them are looking ahead to war. Not the people, not those who fight and pay and die, only those who foment wars and remain safely at home to profit. There are 40 million men under arms in the world today. And our statesmen and diplomats have the terminity to say that war is not in the making. Hell bells. Are these 40 million men being trained to be dancers? Not in Italy, to be sure. Premier Mussolini knows what they are being trained for. He at least is frank enough to speak out. Only the other day, the Deuce in International Conciliation, the publication of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace said, quote, and above all, fascism, the more it considers and observes the future and the development of humanity quite apart from the political considerations of the moment, believes neither in the possibility nor the utility of perpetual peace. War alone brings up to its highest tensions all human energy and puts the stamp of nobility upon the peoples who have the courage to meet it. Unquote. Undoubtedly, Mussolini means exactly what he says. His well-trained army, his great fleet of planes, and even his navy are ready for war, anxious for it, apparently. his recent stand at the side of Hungary in the latter's dispute with Yugoslavia showed that, and the hurried mobilization of his troops on the Austrian border after the assassination of Dollfuss showed it too. There are others in Europe too whose saber-rattling presages war sooner or later. Heil Hitler and his rearming Germany and his constant demand for more and more arms is an equal if not greater menace to peace. France only recently increased the term of military service for its youth from a year to 18 months. Yes, all over, nations are cramping on their arms. The mad dogs of Europe are on the loose. In the Orient, the maneuvering is more adroit. Back in 1904, when Russia and Japan fought, we kicked out our old friends, the Russians, and back Japan. Then our very generous international bankers were financing Japan. Now the trend is to poison us against the Japanese. What does the open door, quote-unquote, policy in China mean to us? Our trade with China is about $90 billion a year. Or the Philippine Islands, we have spent about $600 million in the Philippines in 35 years. And we, our bankers and industrial speculators, have private investments there of less than $200,000. Then to save that China trade of about $90 billion, or to protect these private investments of less than $200 billion in the Philippines, we would be all stirred up to hate Japan and go to war. A war that will cost us tens of billions of dollars, hundreds of thousands of lives of Americans, and many more hundreds of thousands of physically maimed and mentally unbalanced men. Of course, with this loss, there would be a compensating profit. Fortunes will be made. Millions and billions of dollars would be piled on by a few. Munitions makers, shipbuilders, manufacturers, meat packers, speculators, they would bear well. Yes, they are getting ready for war. Why shouldn't they? It pays high dividends. But what does it profit the masses? Who does it profit? The men who are killed? Who does it profit? The men who are maimed? What does it profit? Their mothers and sisters, their wives and their sweethearts. What does it profit their children? What does it profit anyone except the very few to whom war means huge profits? Yes. And what does it profit the nation? Take our own case. Until 1898, we didn't own a bit of territory outside the mainland of North America. At that time, our national debt was little more than $1 billion. Then we became internationally minded, quote-unquote. We forgot or shunted aside the advice of the fathers of our country. We forgot Washington's warning about, quote, entangling alliances, unquote. We went to war. We acquired outside territory. At the end of the World War period, as a direct of our fiddling in international affairs, our national debt had jumped to over $25 billion. Therefore, on purely financial bookkeeping basis, we ran a little behind year for year, and that foreign trade might well have been ours without the war. It would have been far cheaper, not to say safer, for the average American who pays the bills to stay out of foreign entanglements. For a very few, this racket, like bootlegging and other underworld rackets, brings fancy profits, but the cost of operations is always transferred to the people who do not profit. Now, that was just the beginning of a little piece from War is a Racket by the legendary Brigadier General Smedley Butler. Smedley Darling Butler. Who was a Marine general for years and outlined some of his experience in his classic book, War is a Racket. Now we're going to deal with this aspect of the corporate racket of the institution of the private capital war-making machine. As we deal with the real racket called capitalism, in this Beyond the Shadow segment called Blood Money, the corporate structuring of the world societies for permanent imperial wars and economic conquest. So first, let's start off with Antonio Juhas, author of the recent book, The Bush Agenda. And here, let's hear Antonio talk about the puppet leadership in Iraq that's there to serve, amongst other things, geopolitical corporate interests in the Iraqi situation, and how this helps serve the corporate imperial agenda. So check this out.
But I would argue that the most important member of the new leadership is Adel Abdel Mahdi, who has been in every U.S. appointed Iraqi government post the invasion. He was the finance minister of the interim government, the vice president of the transitional government, and was just named vice president of the permanent government. He was actually the man that the Bush administration wanted to be the new prime minister of Iraq. The deal that was worked out was that another member of the Dawa party, just like Mr. Zafari, would become prime minister. And then Mahdi, who is a member of the Siri party, would be vice president. It's a position that allows him to continue to be the most aggressive advocate of the Bush agenda in Iraq, which I argue is opening Iraq, continuing to open Iraq to U.S. corporate invasion. Currently, 150 U.S. corporations have received $50 billion worth of contracts, as you said in the introduction, to utterly fail in reconstruction in Iraq, but the money has still been granted. And Mahdi is the person who advanced Paul Bremer's 100 orders in Iraq that opened up the economy. But more importantly to the Bush administration, he is the person who has most aggressively pushed their agenda for a new oil law in Iraq, which would open up Iraq's oil sector, the vast majority of Iraq's oil sector, to private foreign corporate investment.
So as we can see, as Antonio outlined, not much has changed. As the opening up of the Iraqi oil sector for quote-unquote private investors, private corporate investment, is nothing but an imperial ploy for imperial penetration, for the imperial class, for privatized capitalist genocidal domination. In other words, war is a racket. 150 types of various, or 100 orders laid out by Bremer, and then $50 billion worth of contracts to rebuild, quote unquote, Iraq, are spread out like manure for these disaster capitalists. The more war, the more devastating the war, the more prolonged the war, the more profit for the capitalist war sectors. The arms merchants, Lockheed, Raytheon, PRW, Boeing, help blow up the masses of people and the places where they live to smithereens, and then the disaster capitalists slither in the so-called mode of rebuilding, and then of course the geopolitical thieves of energy resources, the Exxon Mobiles, the Chevrons, etc., etc., then use the new imperializing grip that is now unfolded on the population to have rewritten negotiations, documents, so that the contracts are now in their favor for penetration and exploitation of a country's resources. And of course, this whole thing helps restructure the geopolitical game where all the major imperialists are fighting on a grand chessboard to try to geopolitically capture major resource centers throughout the planet, where pipelines flow through, where large reserves of hydrocarbon or natural gas are in existence, where choke points are in existence, the Straits of Hamas in Iran, the Panama Canal, etc., etc., all to geopolitically be able to control the distribution of world resources for private domination within the sphere of the market capitalist genocidal game. And the way these things are geopolitically played out, war through blood money, through the corporate structuring of world societies for permanent and continuous imperial wars and economic conquest. That's the real world. And that's the game that these savages have the world's populations locked into. Now, continuing on with Smedley Butler's War is a Racket, Chapter 2, Who Makes the Profits? The World War, whether our brief participation in it, has cost the United States some $52 billion. Figured out, that means $400 to every American man, woman, and child. And we haven't paid the debt yet. We are paying it. Our children will pay it. And our children's children probably still will be paying the cost of that war. The normal profits of a business concern in the United States are 6, 8, 10, and sometimes even 12%. But wartime profits, that is another matter. 20, 60, 100, 300, and even 1800%. The sky is the limit. All that the traffic will bear. Uncle Sam has the money. Let's get it. Of course, it isn't put that crudely in wartime. It is dressed into speeches about patriotism, love of country, and, quote, we must all put our shoulder to the wheel, unquote. But the profits jump and leap and skyrocket and are safely pocketed. Let's just take a few examples. Take our friends, the DuPonts, the powder people. Didn't one of them testify before a Senate committee recently that their powder won the war or something? How did they do in the war? They were a patriotic corporation. Well, the average earning of DuPont from the period of 1910 to 1914 was $6 million a year. It wasn't much. But the DuPonts managed to get along on it. Now, let's look at their average yearly profits during the war years, 1914 to 1918. $58 million a year profit, we find. Nearly 10 times that of normal times. And the profits of normal times were pretty good. An increase in profits of more than 950%. Take one of our little steel companies that so patriotically shunted aside in making of rails and girders and bridges to manufacture war material. Well, their 1910 to 1914 yearly earnings averaged $6 million. Then came the war. And like loyal citizens, Bethlehem Steel promptly turned to munitions making. Did their profits jump, or did they let Uncle Sam in for a bargain? Well, their 1914 to 1918 average was $49 million a year. Well, let's take the United States Steel. The normal earnings during the five-year period prior to the war were $105 million a year. Not bad. Then came along the war, and up went the profits. The average yearly profit for the period 1914 to 1918 was $240 million. Not bad. There you have some of the steel and powder earnings. Let's look at something else. A little copper, perhaps. That always does well in war times. Andacana, for instance, averaged yearly earnings during the pre-war years from 1910 to 1914 of $10 million during the war years. Now, 1914 to 1918 profits leaped to $34 million per year. Or Utah Copper averages $5 million per year during 1910 to 1914 period, jumped to an average of $21 million yearly profits for the war period. Let's group these five with three smaller companies. The total yearly average profits of the pre-war period, 1910 to 1914, were $137,480,000. Then along came the war. The average profit for this group skyrocketed from $137,480,000 to $408,300,000. A little increase in profits of approximately 200%. Does war pay? It paid them. But they aren't the only ones. There are still others. Let's take leather. For the three-year period before the war, the total profits of Central Leather Company was $3,500,000. That was approximately $1,167,000 a year. Well, in 1916, Central Leather returned a profit of $15,500,000, an increase of 1,100%. That's all. The General Chemical Company averaged a profit for the 3 years before the war of little over $800,000 a year. Then came the war, and the profits jumped to $12 million, a leap of 1,400%. International Nickel Company, and you can't have a war without nickel, showing an increase in profit from a mere average of $4 million a year to $73,500,000 yearly. Not bad. An increase of more than 1,700%. American Sugar Refinery Company averaged $200,000 a year for the 3 years before the war. In 1916, a profit of $6 million was recorded. Listen to the Senate document number 259, the 65th Congress reporting on the corporate earnings and government revenues considering the profits of 122 meat packers, 153 cotton manufacturers, 299 garment makers, 49 steel plants, and 340 coal producers during the war. Profits under 25% were exceptional. For instance, the coal companies made between 100% and 7,856% on their capital stock during the war. The Chicago Packers doubled and tripled their earnings. And let us not forget the bankers who financed the Great War. If anyone had the cream of the profits, it was the bankers. Being partnership rather than incorporated organizations, they do not have to report to stockholders, and their profits were as secret as they were immense. But the bankers made their millions and their billions. I do not know, because those little secrets never become public. Even before a Senate investigation body. But here, how some of the other patriotic industrialists and speculators chiseled their way into war profits. Take the shoe people. They like war. It brings business with abnormal profits. They made huge profits on sales abroad to our allies. Perhaps like the munitions manufacturers and armament makers, they also sold to the enemy. For a dollar is a dollar, whether it comes from Germany or from France. But they did well by Uncle Sam too. For instance, they sold Uncle Sam 35 million pairs of hobnob service shoes. There were 4 million soldiers, 8 pairs of shoes, and more to a soldier. My regiment during the war had only a pair to a soldier. Some of these shoes probably are still in existence. They were good shoes. But when the war was over, Uncle Sam had a matter of 25 million pairs left over, bought and paid for. Profits recorded and pocketed. Now let me stop right there for a sec. So once again, as we can see in this whole blood money game, who really has historically made the super profit, and how this game is engineered. And why this is such a massive racket. A racket that the exploiters of the world never want to give up. But just like in the past, where they like to portray themselves as patriotic missionaries of justice under the flag, just like during the first war, world war, as Smedley noted, as people bringing quote unquote democracy. How many generations have we been hearing this same old game? Now, let's go into some of the background of some of these guys a little bit. You know, right now, Kellogg, Brown & Root is a subsidiary of Halliburton. But Brown & Root, as it first started off, came to being in 1919 by Herman Brown and Dan Root. And it started off as a road paving company. They got jobs through outsourced government work, and they used political retainers. Then Brown and Root set to get what was called the Marshall Ford Dam in 1930. This was right outside of Austin, Texas. It was a $10 million contract. And their then political crony at the time, who had been pushing this guaranteed project through, was a Texas congressperson named James Buchanan. Well, Buchanan kicked the bucket, and he was also at the time the chairman of the House Appropriations Committee. So the dam site at the time Buchanan kicked the bucket wasn't owned by the federal government, and the dam had not been approved by the federal government. Now, Brown and Root had gone some $1.5 million in the debt, purchasing equipment and other things needed for the dam project. So they felt that they were at a point of no return, that they must proceed. So they went ahead and start building the dam before they had gotten any federal funding. Enter LBJ, Lyndon Baines Johnson. Johnson met with Herman Brown a few times and told Herman Brown that he would make the dam project an essential topic if, of course, he got Buchanan, the departed Buchanan, spot. What then started to take place was a special election for the departed congressman. LBJ, on May 13, 1937, was drafted into the network of this whole corporate thing, and got the spot after backing by Brown and Root. 1 week later, after arriving in Washington, Johnson came through on his pledge to Brown and got the dam approved and purchased. Tom Corcoran once said that, quote, LBJ's whole world was built on that dam, unquote. During World War II, Lyndon B. Johnson, who was also on the Congressional Committee overseeing the operations of U.S. Navy, sailed all the major contracts he can get his paws on by the government to his corporate financer. This is how Brown and Root became a major player in the Pentagon contracting no risk, cost plus game. And how this cost plus game works is that you're guaranteed to be paid for the project, and then you get a percentage of profit off of the particular project. So whatever the cost is, you get paid for the completion of the project, and then you get 1%, it could be up to 9% of a profit off of how much the project costs. Now, to show you how insidious this type of game works, as an example, in 1940, Brown and Root won a major contract, Corpus Christi Navy Air Station. They were doing hangars, barracks, complex runways. It was a command center of about 2,000 acres. The price tag initially was $23.5 million. That was guaranteed, with a profit of $1.2 million. Within a year, the cost soared to $45 million, and Brown & Root's profit guaranteed, cost plus guaranteed profit, soared to $2.4 million. The project ended up costing $125 million. The bigger the project, the more the profit. There's no incentive to have these projects come in on time because it's not like a competitive bid. These are handouts, corporate welfare handouts to large, powerful corporations. Now, as I said, so these corporate cost plus scams are completely risk-free for the corporation. So the federal dam project during the Depression was just another layer of capitalist racket projects. But as things evolved in this whole process, LBJ and later on a Houston congressperson named Albert Thomas got the Navy to give Brown and Root major shipbuilding contracts. Now, remember, Brown and Root, they were just a road paving company. They had never even built a ship. And already, within years, they're building ships in, Navy air stations and things of that matter, with hangars and all of that type of stuff. So basically, they're the general contractors, and they're subletting out the project. The people who really do the work, they don't really do the work, but they have cronies in high positions of power that give them and lay out to them, roll out to them major contracts. So this major shipbuilding contract, and as I said, Brown and Root was no damn shipbuilding company. As a matter of fact, Robert Bryce himself said that Brown and Root, quote, had never built so much as a canoe, unquote. But over 5 years, Brown's shipbuilding setup had built over 335 ships for the Navy, sub chasers and escorts for destroyers. $500 million was made by them for their troubles. Then Brown and Root melted 20,000 surplus airplanes at war's end. They bought them on the cheap from the War Asset Administration. Now, from this melting of the airplanes after the war, Brown and Root was now a player in the aluminum business, and they sold the aluminum back to the federal government, profiting tens of millions of dollars. You're damn right, war is a racket. And so from war, the first war, as we went into with Smedley, as he was describing, because that was the era he was writing about, but or initially writing about, and he was talking about the upcoming war that was in the process of development, as you heard him mention Mussolini and Hitler and all of those guys, and how the next racket on the world stage was about to take place. Well, as we're going into with the development of these corporate imperial blood money vampires, this is it. The war, the racket in World War II is being played out by the likes of Brown and Root. Now, and others. It wasn't just Brown and Root. I'm just giving them as a, you know, one small example. Now, Brown and Root had a lawyer named Alvin Wirtz, and he helped LBJ steal the 1948 Senate election from Coke Stevenson. This was under the whole famous Box 13 scam in, you know, Alice, Texas, where 220 votes all for LBJ slithered him into the lead by 87 votes and on and on. The 220 names that were added after the polls were closed were later exposed by LBJ's biographer, Robert Carroll. So, it's interesting, this little detail, because Coke Stevenson initially won relief in court, but the race was decided by one Supreme Court justice, a New Dealer, ex-Ku Klux Klansman, Hugo Black. Wirtz, the Brown and Root's lawyer, convinced Hugo Black that LBJ was important to the New Deal programs. And what this office that LBJ was running for was to be senator. You know, he had been a congressman. He would have even more power and influence as a senator. Brown and Root was backing him all the way. He had to go up against Coke Stevenson. He really lost the election. They just manipulated the stuff and stole the election. The Supreme Court had some concerns about it. And then they just did some, you know, fast talking swindling by Brown and Root's a lawyer. And basically, Hugo Black stopped the investigations on September 29th, 1948, overturning the state judge's injunction on the whole voting fraud scandal that LBJ was engaged in. And he was pronounced the primary winner by 87 votes, and went on to beat the Republican with the backing of Brown and Root. As a matter of fact, LBJ has gone on record saying that his rise into the Senate had been, quote, Brown and Root funded. So it's just bodacious about about how this game has been played. And part of the reason why I'm mentioning this is that these things have developed over time to the point where Halliburton had been another major company in development, and they basically, unlike Brown and Root, who had a Democratic backer, Earl P. Red Halliburton was someone who had been kind of in the whole Republican mode and Republican camp. In other words, the cronies he backed were basically Republicans. And he started in 1919 also. And basically, he started the New Method Oil Well Cementing Company. And he innovated what was called a cement jet mixture, which basically sealed well pipes into sheets of concrete, protecting them from corrosion, which protected the crude oil from contamination. So basically, they just invented a way of when the pipes went deep into the ground, they had a coating of concrete that would stop the pipes from bursting. And he was able to parlay this idea that he did have, you know, on and on. But as we know, with the evolution of these corporations, they don't stop there. And Halliburton, just like Brown and Root, found itself evolving as time went on into a major international corporate imperial a federation with large government, no risk, cost plus contracts that ended up deeply penetrating into the world stage of capital influence and imperialism. I'll deal with this in a sec. But first, let's go on back to Smedley Butler and the whole war is a racket. Continuing on with chapter 2. Quote, there was still a lot of leather to be left. So the leather people sold your Uncle Sam hundreds of thousands of McLean saddles for the cavalry. But there wasn't any American cavalry overseas. Somebody had to get rid of this leather. However, somebody had to make a profit on it. So we had a lot of those McLean saddles, and we probably have those yet. Also, somebody had a lot of mosquito nettings. They sold your Uncle Sam 20 million mosquito nets for the use of the soldiers overseas. I suppose the boys were expected to put it over them as they tried to sleep in the muddy trenches, one hand scratching cooties on their back. And the other making passes at scurrying rats. Well, not one of those mosquito nets ever got to France. Anyhow, these thoughtful manufacturers wanted to make sure that no soldiers would be without his mosquito net. So 40 million additional yards of mosquito netting were sold to Uncle Sam. There was pretty good profits in mosquito nettings in war days, even if there were no mosquitoes in France. I suppose if the war had lasted just a little longer, the enterprising mosquito netting manufacturers would have sold your Uncle Sam a couple of consignments of mosquitoes to plant in France so that the more mosquito nettings would be in order. Airplane and engine manufacturers felt they too should get their profits out of this war. Why not? Everybody else was getting theirs. So, 1 billion, count them if you live long enough, was spent by Uncle Sam in building airplanes and airplane engines that never left the ground. Not one plane or motor out of the $1 billion worth ordered ever got into battle in France. Just the same, the manufacturers made their little profit of 30, 100, or perhaps 300%. Undershirts with soldiers cost 14 cents to make, and Uncle Sam paid 30 cents to 40 cents each for them. A nice little profit for the undershirt manufacturers, and the stocking manufacturers, and the uniform manufacturers, and the cap manufacturers, and the steel helmet manufacturers all got theirs. Why? When the war was over, some 4 million sets of equipment, knapsacks, and the things that go to fill them, cram warehouses on this side. Now, they were being scrapped because the regulations had changed the contents, but the manufacturers collected their wartime profits on them, and they will do it all over again the next time. There were lots of brilliant ideas for profit-making during the war. One very versatile patriot sold Uncle Sam 12 dozen 48-inch wrenches. Oh, they were very nice wrenches. The only trouble was that they were was only one nut ever made that was large enough for these wrenches. That is the one that holds the turbines at Niagara Falls. Well, after Uncle Sam had bought them and the manufacturer had pocketed the profit, the wrenches were put on freight cars and shunted all around the United States in an effort to find a use for them. When the armistice was signed, it was indeed a sad blow to the wrench manufacturer. He was just about to make some nuts to fit the wrenches. Then he planned to sell these too to your Uncle Sam. Still another had the brilliant idea that colonials shouldn't ride in automobiles, nor should they even ride horseback. One had probably seen a picture of Andy Jackson riding on buckboard. Well, some 6,000 buckboards were sold to Uncle Sam. for the use of colonials. Not one of them was used, but the buckboard manufacturer got his war profit. The shipbuilders felt they should come in on some of it. Two, they built a lot of ships that made a lot of profit, more than $3 billion worth. Some to the ships were all right, but $650 million worth of them were made of wood and wouldn't float. The seams opened up and they sank. We paid for them, though, and somebody pocketed the profits. It has been estimated by statisticians and economists that researchers that the war cost your Uncle Sam $52 billion. Of this sum, $39 billion was expended in the actual war period. The expenditure yielded $16 billion in profit. That is how the 21,000 billionaires and millionaires got their way. This $16 billion in profit is not to be sneezed at. It is quite a tidy sum, and it went to a very few. The Senate Mee Committee probe of the munitions industry and its wartime profits, despite its sensational disclosure, hardly ever scratched the surface. Even so, it had some effect. The State Department has seen studying, quote, for some time, unquote, methods of keeping out of war. The War Department suddenly decided it had a wonderful plan to spring. The administration names a committee with the War and Navy Department, ably represented under the chairmanship of a Wall Street speculator, to limit profits in wartime. A Wall Street speculator to limit profits in wartime. To what extent isn't suggested? Possibly the profits of 300 and 600 and 1600% of those who turned blood into gold into the World War would be limited to a smaller figure. Apparently, however, the plan does not call for any limitization of losses, that is, the losses of those who fight the war. As far as I have been able to ascertain, there is nothing in the scheme to limit a soldier to the loss of but one eye or one arm, or to limit his wounds to one or two or three, or to limit the loss of life. There is nothing in this scheme, apparently, that says not more than 12% of the regiment shall be wounded in battle, or that not more than 7% in a division should be killed. Of course, the committee cannot be bothered with such trifling matters. So let me stop right there on Smedley's War is a Racket right quick. And as we've seen, as Smedley was talking about what he had seen and experienced during World War One, and why, in part, he was worried about what was in the developmental stages as they were about to take place during World War II, which is part of the reason why it prompted him to write this War is a Racket book. You can see the direct stream of capital privatized exploitations from one group of corporate plunderers during the war and everything else during our life to the current situation that the masses of people find themselves in under the hooves of these corporate war bandits. It's an ongoing tradition because the way the market system is set up, it is set up for human exploitation, human control, dominance of resources, and a benefit for the few at the incredible cost of the many. talk a little bit about Halliburton's kind of evolution, at least during a Vietnam era. You know, during that Vietnam War, Lyndon B. Johnson, who became president after, you know, Kennedy got his head shot off, the Pentagon began to privatize construction, logistic operations during the actual time of war in war zones. In 1965, Halliburton formed a consortium with an Idaho-based firm called Morrison Cutson to manage major construction projects for the Pentagon in Nam. From 1965 to 1970, contracts would grow beyond $2 billion. Of course, they were all cost-plus, with, as I said before, these are guaranteed built-in profits. Halliburton's employees in Vietnam built everything from latrines to construction of barracks. They dug wells. They managed commissionaries. They excavated harbors throughout the Da Nang to the Cam Ranh Bay. Halliburton received $220 million in contracts to build an Air Force base, and Halliburton abandoned what was called normal management controls. They wasted millions in the whole General Accounting Office, or as the General Accounting Office disclosed. And they stated that Halliburton, quote, could not account for the whereabouts of approximately $120 million worth of material which had been shipped from the U.S. to Vietnam. Now, this report, and this was during the Vietnam era, was this report that came out was ignored by the media. So everything from what Smedley was talking about in the 1930s, in the whole racket of the whole market order, is what we could see taking place, or what we saw, or could read about, or come to understand that took place and was in the formation of privatized war-making development at another stage where these guys help foster and develop the careers of these politicians, who then help lay out contracts and deregulate industry and guidelines so that these corporations can have more influence in the whole sphere of international corporate privatized affairs. And of course, within the sphere of the capitalist market game, war is one of those choice affairs that the privatizers love to engage in. Now, in Iraq, in the first 6 months, the Pentagon auditors estimated that Halliburton, now I just talked about how in Nam, the General Accounting Office disclosed that Halliburton could not account for the whereabouts of approximately $120 million worth of materials which had been shipped from the U.S. to Vietnam. This was in one of their reports, and of course ignored by the corporate media during the Vietnam years. In Iraq, during the first 6 months, the Pentagon auditors estimated Halliburton had overcharged the U.S. Treasury by $61 million for fuel deliveries, at the very least. A subsidiary of Halliburton said that they were forced to charge large amounts to cover kickbacks and bribes they were forced to pay Halliburton to get contracts. So this is what I mean by Halliburton is becomes through these cost plus general contract, the general contractor. So they get these incredibly large cost plus contracts. They quite often don't do a lot of the specialized, right, some of these cases aren't specialized, but say, you know, building ships and all of that, like the Brown and Root boys had gotten into. They don't really build ships. So they find subcontractors who bid on the projects to them to build the ships. And then through that, give these contracts, these subcontracts, to these particular players. But they before they give these subcontracts out to these guys to do the work, they expect bribes and kickbacks and all of this type of stuff. There's no incentive for these projects to be done on time, because the longer it takes, the more it costs, the more built-in profit they get. So here you have a situation where we've seen in Iraq where the water supply, the electrical supply in Iraq, in many of the regions, is still not online permanently, even though months after the first imperial bombing of Iraq, the Iraqi people had gotten these types of things back into service. But with the blood money imperial capitalists, there's no incentive to rebuild these things back right away, because the longer it takes, the more you drag your feet, the higher the bill costs, the more money you make. It's a blood money operation. Now, the fact that this helps stir up more insurrection because people become more desperate and angered is one of the contradictions that the capitalists develop for themselves, and in a sense help load the ammo, the AK, in part for their own destruction. But since many of them are looking at it for, from their own particular vantage point, in other words, Halliburton's looking at it from their disaster capitalist exploitation, Bechtel is looking at it from their disaster capitalist exploitation, where a banker who's worried about the fluctuating and declining dollar system as more and more countries are losing faith in the dollar because of the growing instability of the region, that wing of capitalists is shaking his head about what's going on. But you have another group of capitalists, the arms capitalists, the TRWs, the Lockheeds, and the disaster capitalists, who are quite content with the way this particular occupation is going on in Iraq at this current time, because war is a racket, a capitalist racket for capitalist profits, and they see massive amounts of profits taking place like the big oil does, even though the long-term effect of what they are laying out may, and hopefully will, if the slaves of the world get it together, mean their own demise. But this is how the game works when you're dealing with racketeers. And that's what they are. They're just capitalist racketeers, bandits, psychopaths. Now, Dick Cheney, as we all know, was a former CEO of Halliburton. Halliburton made a deal in Iraq of $2.5 billion. You know, the whole disaster capital. This is one of their deals. More than $1.5 billion was funded in Iraqi oil sales. And this was overseen by the UN. So here, these guys have a situation where they're in the disaster capitalist mode, and these bandits, these racketeers, are cutting in to the oil reserves of a sovereign, well, not really sovereign country, because this is occupation. See, this is why You know, when you hear all this bring the truth back, or trying to say that there's this one interest or one element or one lobbyist group or, you know, any of that type of stuff that spearheads these types of things, it's really kind of like lost in space talk and not dealing with the whole privatized setup that at its core is thievery. Now, Waxman commented on this whole madness, saying that, quote, "The evidence suggests that the Pentagon used Iraqi oil proceeds to overpay Halliburton, and then the company and the Pentagon sought to hide the evidence of these overcharges from the international auditors," unquote. So, once again, you see how the whole corruption from Smedley's time to this time is a blood money war is a racket mechanism based in capitalist filth. Now, Halliburton's billing of $27.5 million, this is what they charge for shipping cooking gas and heating fuel that the Pentagon auditors valued at how much? $82,000. So, basically, just going down the list of current scams that Halliburton and Bechtel and all of them have been involved in, it's just another version of a war is a racket. From May 2003 to March 2004, Halliburton sent the Corps of Engineers bills over $875 million for supplies of fuel to SAM's operations in Iraq, overbilling the cost of at least $108.4 million, according to Pentagon auditors. Then Halliburton refused to hand over any information on his subcontractors in Kuwait. Quote, "Halliburton failed to demonstrate his prices for Kuwaiti fuel were fair and reasonable," unquote, according to auditors. Halliburton played some game, you know, towards auditors concerning the whole thing in a similar way with deals they got on in Jordan and Turkey and so on and so forth. Now, where I started off with some of these guys, outside of the Smedley Butler book, Brown and Root, which is now Kellogg Brown and Root, which is now Halliburton subsidiary, Halliburton's subsidiary Kellogg Brown and Root, $442 million of unsupported quote-unquote billings in Iraq, including mules that were never served, unnecessary heavy equipment, and $152,000. Yeah, $152,000 they had for movie screening. So they just pimping. It's straight up pimping. A report by the Democratic Policy Committee estimated that Halliburton overcharged overcharging in Iraq alone has been over $1 billion. Now, in response to the July 2005 the Pentagon awarded Halliburton a new contract of $5 billion in July of 2005. And of course, it was no bid, and of course, cost plus. Yeah, war is a racket. It's a deadly racket. Because it's built in the whole capitalist enterprising game of exploitation and death. Now let's go back to Antonia, and let her describe the sham of the planning, quote-unquote, post-war Iraq when it's outlined by the imperial corporate forces who are in a constant class war against world societies. So let's check her out.
Dig this.
It's a myth that there was not a post-war planning done by the Bush administration. The reason why it failed was because the interest it was serving the U.S. multinationals, not reconstruction in Iraq. That plan was ready 2 months before the invasion. It was written by Bearing Point Inc., a company based in Virginia, that received a $250 million contract to rewrite the entire economy of Iraq. It drafted that new economy. That new economy was put into place systematically by Eltel Bremer, the head of the occupation government of Iraq, for 14 months. He implemented exactly 100 orders, basically all of which are still in place today. And everyone who's watching who is familiar with the policies of the World Trade Organization, the North American Free Trade Agreement, the World Bank, the IMF, will understand the orders. They implement some of the most radical corporate globalization ideas, such as free investment rules for multinational corporations. That means corporations can enter Iraq and they essentially don't have to contribute at all to the economy of Iraq. The most harmful provision thus far has been the national treatment provision, which meant that the Iraqis could not give preference to Iraqi companies or workers in the reconstruction, and therefore U.S. companies received preference in the reconstruction. They hired workers who weren't even from Iraq in most cases, and utterly bungled the reconstruction. And most important company in my mind to receive blame is the Bechtel Corporation of San Francisco. They have received $2.8 billion to rebuild water, electricity, and sewage systems, the most important systems in the life of an Iraqi. After the first Gulf War, the Iraqis rebuilt these systems in 3 months' time. It's been 3 years. Services are still below 311. Same point was KPMG Consulting that had to change its name in the wake of the Arthur Andersen scandal. The Bearing Point picked up all of Arthur Andersen's old clientele and is essentially just the reborn KPMG. And Bearing Point, you probably haven't heard of, though, because they work in the back room. They write things like new economic policies, but are not the people seen on the ground implementing the policies. Actually, there's a wonderful story that I tell in the book by a member of the Coalition Provisional Authority, the U.S. Occupation Government Iraq, who says, one day these people from this place called Bearing Point came up and started telling us about these economic policies that were so unrealistic, I didn't know who they were and what they were talking about. But what they were talking about was an economic agenda that seemed completely ridiculous for the people on the ground who were looking at, you know, sewage flowing through the streets and Iraqis saying over and over and over again, the most important thing we need is electricity, just electricity, just give us our electricity back, and failing to do it. But this was Bearing Point, and they are still there. Their contract was renewed. They're still focusing in particular on privatization of Iraq's state-owned enterprises. That's almost the sole focus of their current contract, and that contract goes, I believe, until 2007.
So once again, we can see how this whole pimping mechanism just goes on, and how deadly of a game it is. From Bearing Point to Bechtel, the whole water electrical sham not being rebuilt because they're not there to help rebuild. They're not there to help rebuild people's lives. They're there to dominate people's lives, to control people's lives, and to exploit the lives, the resources, and the regions that the masses of people live in. This is the real world. This is how the game is truly played. Now, back to Smedley Butler's War is a Racket book, Chapter 3. Who pays the bills? Who provides the profits? These nice little profits of 20, 100, 300, 1500, 1800%. We pay them in taxation. We paid the bankers their profits when we bought Liberty Bonds at $100 and sold them back at $84 or $86 to the banker. These bankers collected $100 plus. It was a simple manipulation. The bankers controlled the security marks. It was easy for them to depress the prices of these bonds. Then all of us, the people, got frightened and sold the bonds at $84 or $86. The bankers bought them. Then these same bankers stimulated a boom and government bonds went to par and above. Then the bankers collected their profits. But the soldier pays the biggest part of the bills. If you don't believe this, visit the American cemeteries on the battlefields abroad, or visit any of the veterans' hospitals in the United States. On a tour of the country, in the midst of which I am at this time of this writing, I have visited 18 government hospitals for veterans. In them are a total of about 50,000 destroyed men, men who were the pick of the nation's 18 years ago. The very able chief surgeon at the government hospital at Milwaukee, where there are 3,800 of the living dead, told me that the mortality among veterans is three times as great as among those who stayed at home. Boys with normal viewpoints were taken out of the fields and offices and factories and classrooms and put into the ranks. They are remolded. They are made over. They are made to about face, to regard murder as the order of the day. They were put shoulder to shoulder, and through mass psychology, they were entirely changed. We used them for a couple of years and trained them to think nothing at all of killing or being killed. Then suddenly, we discharged them and told them to make another about face, quote unquote. This time, they had to do their own readjusting, sans mass psychology, sans officers, aid and advice, sans nationwide propaganda. We didn't need them anymore, so we scattered them about without any 3-minute or liberty loan speeches or parades. Many, too many of these fine young boys are eventually destroyed mentally because they could not make that final about face, quote unquote, alone. In the government hospital at Marion, Indiana, 1,800 of these boys are in pens, 500 of them in a barracks with steel bars and wires all across and outside the building and on porches. These already have been mentally destroyed. These boys don't even look like human beings. Oh, the look on their faces. Physically, they are in good shape. Mentally, they are gone. There are thousands and thousands of these cases, and more are coming in all the time. The tremendous excitement of the war, the sudden cutting off of the excitement. The young boys couldn't stand it. That's a part of the bill. So much for the dead. They have paid that part of the war profits. So much of the mentally and physically wounded. They are paying now their share of the war profits. But the others paid too. They paid with heartbreak when they tore themselves away from their firesides and their families to don the uniform of Uncle Sam, on which a profit had been made. They paid another part in the training camps, where they were regimented and drilled, while others took the jobs and their places in the lives of the community. They paid for in the trenches, where they shot and were shot, where they went hungry for days at a time, where they slept in the mud and in the cold and in the rain, with the moan and shriek of the dying for the horrible lullaby. But don't forget, the soldiers paid part of the dollars and cents bills too. Now let me stop right there for a sec. Now this, when you think about how the game that the G.I. Joes are going to pay and have paid, not only with their little lies, but, you know, getting contaminated with the rest of the Iraqis with depleted uranium, getting 2 bottled waters a day. So if you just dehydrate, because you have to pay for it if you don't, you know, if you want more than the ration of 2 bottled waters a day, then that's just your behind. The lack of vest. And if you had parents or someone send you a vest, then you lose your insurance, according to the government, because of the type of you're not getting the best through them. The Gulf War syndrome, once again, the first one left abandoned all these little G.I. Joes. It's the same game, which is why I'm hard on these cats. If you don't realize that it's these blood money, privatized corporate capitalist plunders within these governmental institutions that are the enemy, and not some little kid running across the street with a candy bar in his hand going to the grocery store for his mom in Iraq, that if you don't realize that he's not the enemy, and as the Imperial Order is the enemy, then, well, hey, you're just a sucker for this racket game that the Imperialists keep imploding, generation after generation, continuing on. Up to and including the Spanish-American War, we had a prize system. The soldiers and sailors fought for money. During the Civil War, they were paid bonuses in many instances before they went to service. The government or state paid as high as $1,200 for the enlistment. In the Spanish-American War, they gave prize money. When we captured any vessels, the soldiers all got their share, at least they were supposed to. Then it was found that we could reduce the cost of wars by taking all the prize money and keeping it, but conscripting the soldiers anyway. Then the soldiers couldn't bargain for their labor. Everyone else could bargain, but the soldiers couldn't. Napoleon once said, "All men are enamored of declarations. They positively hunger for them." Unquote. So by developing the Napoleon system, the metal business, the government learned it could get soldiers for less money because the boys liked to be decorated. Until the Civil War, there were no medals. Then the Congressional Medal of Honor was handed out. It made enlistment easier. After the Civil War, no new medals were issued until the Spanish-American War. In the World War, we used propaganda to make the boys accept conscription. They were made to feel ashamed if they didn't join the army. So vicious was this war propaganda that even God was bought into it. With few exceptions, our clergymen joined in the clamor to kill, 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 to kill the Germans. God is on our side. It is His will that the Germans be killed. And in Germany, the good pastors called upon the Germans to kill the Allies, to please the same God. That was a part of the general propaganda built up to make war consciousness and murder conscious. Now, we see how all these hocus-pocus types like to do this. They love to mix in their hocus-pocus faith with religion, because they know it's kind of a Straussian technique. All of these Straussian guys who are part of the neocon, many of them don't even really believe in this hocus-pocus, you know, sky god stuff. But they believe in, the masses believing in it, because it's easier to manipulate the masses into fighting for God and country and all of that type of rhetoric, because their minds are compartmentalized and privatized by a hierarchical order called religion, which is directly connected to the whole concept of the state, which is why many religious types from all the Abrahamic traditions, you know, Islam, Christianity, Judaism, love to mix in religion and state and say there's not a separation, because they know that that can help further propagandize the minds of the drones that believe in these particular forms of sorcery. Now, while this pimping of the G.I. Joes is going on, let's again hear from Antonio about some of the imperial policies from the true dictators of Iraq and the corporate bunch of thieves and their little agenda game overall. Check this out.
Bremer became the dictator of Iraq. His orders laid out the law. Now, probably the most important thing to know is that that was completely illegal under international law. The Geneva Conventions are very specific about what an occupying power should do. It must provide basic security and services. It cannot change the laws or the political structure of the country it occupies. The Bush administration did exactly the opposite. Changed all the fundamental economic and political laws and utterly failed to provide the security and the basic needs of the Iraqi people. What you hear most often in Iraq today is people saying, please just put us back where we were before you came. Connection. The Bush administration is the most beholden administration probably in American history to the oil and gas industry. This is the first time in history that the president, vice president, and secretary of state are all former energy company officials. In fact, both Bush and White have more experience as energy company officials than they do as government leaders. Cheney outbeats him. He spent 30 years working for government. However, his 5 years at Halliburton have been so profitable that you might say that his Halliburton years outweigh their oil years, because Bush was a very bad oil company executive. But their links to the oil sector are deep. The oil industry provided more than 13 times more money to the Bush-Cheney ticket in the first round of elections than it did to his competitor, 9 times more in the second. And this industry has been absolutely coddled by the Bush administration. Enormous tax subsidies, deregulation, and I would argue a war waged on their behalf. Now, there's two intimate connections between the war and the price of gas. But first, I think it's very important for people to understand that the vertical integration of the oil industry, which has been absolutely exacerbated under the Bush administration, for example, Chevron, Texaco, and Unocal merging into one company, the completion of Exxon and Mobil's merger, you know, all of these little companies merging into enormous behemoths, so that you have Exxon Mobil being the company that has received the highest profits of any company in the world over the last 2 years, ever in the history of the world. That is because of the vertical integration and monopoly power of these companies. That means that they control exploration, production, refining, marketing, and sales. The price of oil at the pump is about 50% the price of a barrel of oil, about 25% taxes, and then the rest is marketing and just the price determined by the company at the pump. So that means that about 18 to 20% is absolutely determined by the oil companies themselves and governed by the companies themselves. So they could reduce the price of oil and reduce their profit margin, or they could jack up the price of oil and increase their profit margin. They've chosen to do the latter. And one of the things that has helped them do that is, first of all, the United States is receiving a tremendous amount of oil from Iraq. Oil is down in overall export and production, but not tremendously so. We were, at pre-war, was 2.5 million barrels a day. We're now at about 2 or 2.2 million barrels a day. But 50% of that, on average, is coming to the United States. And it's being brought to the United States by Chevron and Exxon and Marathon. The myth of dramatically reduced supply has helped them create an argument to the American public, which is, you know, it's a time of war, we're suffering, gas prices are going to go up, you know, everyone needs to, you know, come in and support this because this is war. Well, that's just not true. The companies are using that as a myth to help make it okay for them to receive these utterly ridiculous profits.
Like we've been going over, war is a racket. From put your shoulder to the grindstone in the 1930s to we all must suck it up for the imperialists and accept the exploitation that they're doing in every sector of world societies. From the human toll of people's lives to the gas pump, they're blood money imperialists. And that, in the war racket capitalist game, also helps expose that from the foundation of this country, they've always been in that mode of exploiting the masses of human beings for their own benefit, regardless of the hocus-pocus types of rhetoric that they'll try to have you celebrating shortly on 4th of July. Hold on a sec.
Kandahar Air Base are run by Halliburton. The Camp Stronghold Freedom in Kashmir, Uzbekistan, that's run by Halliburton too. And it's there in Jordan, then Kuwait, then Turkey, then in the Republic of Georgia, then Djibouti, across to Yemen, where they're running U.S. bases. So bases around the world. In addition, they have contracts right here in the United States. They have contracts, for example, running U.S. bases at doing part of the contract in Fort Knox in Kentucky, right here in El Centro in California, all over the country. In addition, they have contracts outside the military of the army itself. They have contracts the prisons in Guantanamo Bay. Those prisons were built by Halliburton using not Cuban labor, but labor that they flew in from the Philippines. Examples outside of the military itself, Halliburton is in charge of repairing 150 U.S. embassies around the world, from Albania to Uzbekistan. Halliburton has a contract to reinforce his bases.
Their biggest contract is this umbrella contract called the LOGCAP, the Logistics Civil Augmentation Program. And there's the revolving door where, personnel go back and forth between the Pentagon and industry. This is sort of like the spin cycle, because first when Cheney was Secretary of Defense under Herbert Walker Bush, he hired Halliburton to do kind of an implementation scope of work study of would it be possible for a private company to be the logistics arm of the U.S. Army if they needed to.
Bless America, my home, sweet home, right? Wait a minute, my home, not by choice, but by bondage. Raped, enslaved, tortured to the grave. It ain't our Independence Day. My home, whose home? No, you mean my sisters and brothers' native Turtle Island people's home. The Indians, but you slaughtered them and took away their independence. Concentration camp, i.e. reservation camp style. So, happy 4th of July. It ain't our Independence Day. Oh, master, give me liberty or give me death. Pat Henry is canonized as one of the best America has in its stance towards liberty and independence for its people. And they're right. 'Cause 8 months after that speech, old Pat, the slaveholder Henry, gave another speech calling for diligent patrols. Slave patrols, that is. Blind man. In an effort to keep his Virginia slaves like his own from accepting the British offer of freedom and independence if they joined the British side in the American Revolutionary War. The so-called War for Independence. But for who? So happy 4th of July. And it is a lie. So while Mr. Give Me Liberty was running around and quoted as saying that slavery was, quote, as repugnant to humanity as it is inconsistent with the Bible, and the destructiveness of liberty, unquote. Well, I'm not going to get into any of that Cain and Abel, Bible, hocus pocus, Abrahamic stuff. But if Pat truly believed that, why didn't he tell America's demented version of a pharaoh, the president, to let my people go, meaning his slaves go? Something even Pat didn't allow to happen even after his own death, because he didn't give a damn about black freedom and independence. So, happy 4th of July. It ain't our Independence Day. Well, maybe except for a few certain Negro types like Clarence Thomas and Ward Connolly. So when America gained its independence in 1776, black was still struck and stuck with slavery, a whip, and a crucifix. So much for our life, liberty, and a pursuit of happiness as a founding father. Yeah, that's what they called him, right? Father of Satan, that is, Thomas Jefferson proclaimed. But once again, liberty for who? Not for the 175 Africans he held enslaved in deep bondage. By 1820, Liberal D. Thomas advocated the expansion of slavery into the Western territories. He whipped and terrorized his slaves like any other traditional American Christian values patriot. By 1822, Jefferson owned 267 slaves. But here's how books like The American Way, and it is The American Way, try to put a spin on this contradiction. Quote, In his notes on the state of Virginia, published in 1787, Thomas Jefferson spoke out against owning slaves. Slavery, he said, made tyrants out of the master and destroyed the spirits of the slaves. Although Jefferson and others who owned slaves spoke against slavery, many people did not believe that a mixed society of equal could work, unquote. The reality is that degenerates like Thomas didn't want to work, because they didn't want it to work, because they physically did not want to work. That's what the slaves were for. And at the end of that period, Thomas and his upperclassmen, slave ideology won out amongst the public that was somewhat grappling with the issue at the time. So, sisters and brothers, happy 4th of July. And it is a lie, because it ain't our Independence Day. Nor was it yours, Brother Dred Scott, when in 1857 you found out as a slave in a free state that your state or status was that still of a slave, as the Supreme Court of white supremacy said that, quote, a Negro had no rights a white man was bound to respect, unquote, because they were too busy bounding you up and us up in chains. Even when we try to escape from the horrors of American slavery, we are diagnosed as having a biological disorder called draptiomania, meaning those slaves that suffered, quote unquote, from the uncontrollable urge to escape from slavery. So being black and free was not only a traditional, biblical, societal, ethical, you know, white man's burden, an economic contradiction, but a biological one. Damn. Now that's an American experience for you. Even though some of these other invisible men believe in religious types and states know no humanity for black either. But that's another horror story of the ages from the Abraham tradition. So happy 4th of July, because it ain't our Independence Day. And if you think it is, try sleeping in one of those Mississippi damn churches one night. You might find more than your soul on fire. Or try living while black in a black neighborhood where drugs are intentionally relocated, courtesy of Sam, to destroy, imprison, and keep depriving black liberty and independence from being realized. Or of the astronomically high toxic waste plants that are located by design in black, Latino, and Indian communities. Where's our independence from this madness? And when, if ever, has it truly come in America? So from the destruction of the Reconstruction period led by racist white Democrats to the Nadar and Jim Crow apartheid period, Independence Day has been a sham. Even the Civil War, where over 200,000 black soldiers fought for freedom, freedom that swines like Abe Lincoln didn't care about, and admitted as much when Lincoln said, quote, I will say then that I am not nor ever have been in favor of bringing about in any way the social or political equality of the white and black races, that I am not nor have ever been in favor of making voters or jurors of Negroes, nor of qualifying them to hold office, nor to intermarry with white people. And I will say in addition to this, that there is a physical difference between the black and white races which I believe will forever forbade the two races from living together on terms of social and political equality. And inasmuch as they cannot so live while they do remain together, there must be the position of superior and inferior. And I, as much as any other man, am in favor of having the superior position assigned to the white race. Unquote. Old Abraham also stated that if he had to free, quote-unquote, slaves to preserve the Union, he would. But if not freeing blacks was not necessary in preserving the Union, then he wouldn't. In other words, preserving the Union was more important than black freedom, black justice, black independence. So happy 4th of July. It ain't our Independence Day. And speaking of slavery, chattel slavery, not wage slavery and these other forms that we're under now, when, if ever, did it really completely end?
Gentlemen, cannot read or write. I got a friend to write this. I never went to school in my life. I worked on this man's farm all my life. I didn't get a cent for my labor until I run away. I'm 35 years old. All we Negroes got to eat was corn, bread, bacon, and a few clothes, and forced to live 10 to 12 in a room. Overseers carried sticks and whips and guns. They whipped children and women and men. They would make men and women strip their clothes down and get down on their knees and sometimes tie them to a place and whip them 25 to 100 lashes at a time. You not dare ask for money or anything else. The overseers seduced any young girls they wanted, and parents could not help them. I would send my name, but I don't want to go back to this farm. I did never commit a crime.
That was in the Library of Congress of a Black Man's Experience in American Slavery, dated October 8th, 1923. Slavery didn't completely end in all pockets of Sam's plantation after the Civil War, but continued up into the 1900s throughout. So with those realities and those raggedy chains of the American presidents binding up black independence at the public auctioning block, the American red, white, and blue patriots sing, parade, really charade around about their independence in this quicksand made of milk and honey. And here's what a white woman wrote to a black organization, what was really going on in the land of the free.
Last Thursday, June 21st, 1923, I was on my way to Harwell, Georgia. I had to wait over about 3.5 hours in order to make the proper connection at a very small place called Houghton Falls, South Carolina. While sitting there, an old grandmother came up to me. She was terribly distressed. She had a daughter in New York who had sent for her, but she had two very dear grandchildren that she was so anxious to see before leaving the place. The mother of the children is dead, and they're kept as slaves under a man by the name of John McCauley. He's white. He's located 10 miles from the little town, running a big farm. He has an overseer by the name of Peach Alexander, with one eye, who's indeed cruel. There are more than 100 Negroes in absolute slavery. They're half clothed, half fed, and have no money. If they show at any time the least resentment, they're whipped severely, very often shot, and at times killed and thrown into the river. They're well guarded at all times so that no one will know of their whereabouts. Whenever a mother or father of a family becomes too old to work, the children have to be given over and they remain there until they're too old. They're perfectly ignorant. There was a girl quite young and unmarried who became a mother. When the baby was between 4 and 5 months old, she was forced to go to the field at the dawn of the day and work till night with her baby in a box. She was so far from the baby at one time that it fell out of the box and the ants ate little holes in the sides of its nostrils, gnawed its ears and around its mouth. This is only one case. What can be done? Please see after this matter at once, and if it is investigated, be very careful on entering the place, for it is well guarded at all times. These are true facts.
A true fact that continued into the 30s and 40s, the 1930s and 40s. A true fact of the hideously barbaric nature and conduct of this nation of people towards black, which leaves the 4th of July celebration hollow and sick, and void of any true independence. Or in other words, early this morning, there was a knock upon my door. I said, early this morning, when there was a knock upon my door. I said, oh, hello, Satan. I guess it's time for me to go. Me and the devil was walking side by side. I said, me and Sam were chained side by side. He said, now get your nigga ass in that boat, because we's about to go for a little ride. He chained me down while we sailed across the ocean blue. I said, Sam slayed me down as we sailed across the ocean blue. And when I looked into old Sam the Satan's eyes, I knew then my independence and freedom was through. Sam took me to the new world. Sam said, I'm taking you to a whole nother world. And after what Sam and his disciples put us through, it would make a savage madman's stomach curl. That's why, early this morning, when there was a knock upon my door, I said, early this morning, there was a knock upon my door. I said, oh, hello, Scratch. I guess it's time for me to go. Me and the devil was chained side by side. I said, me and Mr. Homeland Security Man were chained side by side. He said, now get your nigga ass in that car, cause we's about to go for another ride. This has been Tracy James with a commentary. Happy 4th of July, and it is a lie. Cause sisters and brothers, it ain't our damn Independence Day. Out. The American slave is your 4th of July. I answer, a day that reveals to him more than all other days in the year the gross injustices and cruelty to which he is the constant victim. To him, your celebration is a sham, your boasted liberty an unholy license, your national greatness swelling vanity. Your sounds of rejoicing are empty and heartless. Your denunciations of tyrants, brass-fronted impudence. Your shouts of liberty and equality are hollow mockery. Your prayers and hymns, your sermons and thanksgivings, with all your religious parade and solemnity, are to him mere bombast, fraud, deception, impiety, hypocrisy, a thin veil to cover up crimes which would disgrace a nation of savages. There is not a nation on this earth guilty of practices more shocking and bloody than those of these people of the United States at this very hour. Go where you may, search where you will, roam through all the monarchs and despotisms of the old world. Travel through South America and search out every abuse. And when you have found the last, lay your facts by the side of the everyday practices of this nation. And you will say with me that we're for revolting barbarity and shameless hypocrisy. America reigns without a rival. That was Brother Fred's 1852 speech about a July celebration. And as we know, not much has changed from the blood money corporate capitalists to the war is a racket to the other Abraham cousins who are giving Sam a good run for the money from the Sudan to Israel to Sam's plantation. These blood money dogs must fall for the slaves to live and have their true independence in the world. Until the next time, Tracy James, Slave Revolt, out.